3,150 eyeballs. Now, if that doesn't make you nervous, nothing will. I want to thank the committee for asking me here. I had a special joy when I came here. My sponsor is a member of the Rogers Group, and I want to salute her this morning because she's somebody special in my life. I met her in Fort Lauderdale, and I didn't have a sponsor at the time, and I had had sponsors up until that time, but when you get a few years in the program, you ask people, oh, no, I can't sponsor you, and you know more than I do, and all that garbage that they hand you. And I kept saying to this person, well, would you be my sponsor? She said, no, we'll just be friends. And we were at a conference one day, and Clancy was at the podium, and you know Clancy. Anyway, Clancy's up there saying, everybody should have a sponsor. And I turned around to her, and I said, well, did you hear that? And that's how I got Eve Marsh as my sponsor. And I just want to honor her today. She's 51 years of sobriety, and I love her to death. There truly is joy in the journey. You know, it's just, it's been great. I don't really have too much to say today because Paul told a third of my story. And Jerry told a third of my story. And Mary finished it off. So that's about it. I'll see you later. Anyway, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Back to Basics group in North Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And I'm Pat Murphy. Hi, everyone. My sobriety date is the same as Eve's, except 30 years apart. I got sober on January 6, 1975. And by God's grace, the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and rooms like this with people like you, I stayed away from that drink one day at a time. And I am eternally grateful for that. I was not a pretty drunk. I will get to that in a few minutes. But I was not a pretty drunk. I was not a bad kid. I was kind of cute, actually. I didn't know that. See, I have wonderful eyesight today. I have trifocals, which means my eyesight literally is not great. In fact, the next step is a German Shepherd. But I just know that the eyesight I have today is wonderful because it's the eyesight or the clarity of hindsight. I can look back and see a lot about myself and a lot about my childhood and a lot about who I am today from here looking back. I couldn't see it when I was young. I always looked at you and compared what was going on inside of me with the way you looked on the outside. So I spent my whole life comparing my insides to your outsides. I wanted to feel the way you looked. I was 5'8". I swear to God, I was born 5'8". But by the time I was 12, I was 5'8". I'm Irish, Italian, Greek, Roman Catholic. I'm the middle of three daughters. I was born in the middle of Manhattan, and none of that caused my alcoholism. I'd love to tell you it did. I'd love to tell you because I was raised Catholic. I'm an alcoholic. You know, we hear about that too, don't we? Or Baptist. It seems Catholics and Baptists get the blame for alcoholism on a moment-to-moment basis. How'd you get here? I'm Catholic. Or down where I am, I'm Baptist. Yeah. You are too? Okay. My schools didn't do it. My sisters went to the same school. They had the same parents. They went to the same church. And they drank. And they're not alcoholic. So it can't be those things that caused my alcoholism. I have an illness. It's called alcoholism. David says it's more an illness than a disease. I don't know if, I'm not sure if that. My concept is it could be both. I don't really care what it is. I know I have it. I found out I had it 22 years after I got it. And it's a long time to have a disease and not know you have it. It doesn't really matter today, but when I realized I had it, I thought, my God, all those years I've wasted. Not one of them was wasted. At 16, I graduated high school. I was a pretty good kid, and my parents were great parents. They did everything they could for me. I will never use the term enabler to describe my parents. My parents loved me. They absolutely loved me, and they did everything they could do to help me. Now, a lot of it may have been wrong, but their intention was never wrong. They always wanted to help me. And I don't know, the term enabler makes me nervous because it's a connotation there that's kind of like you didn't do it right. They didn't cause me to be who I am today. My alcoholism caused it, not them. So they didn't do anything wrong. They did everything they could do. I look at myself today. Today I do everything I can do today, you know, and I do the best I can. Sometimes it's not as good as what I should be doing or could be doing or whatever. So how can I fault them? My dad told me after I got sober that my mom cried every night for 2 years. Every night. Blaming herself for my problem. That's tough, you know? And I'm not going to turn around and say, they enabled me. Crap. Absolute crap. Our co-founder, not Bill Smith, Bill Wilson, but Bob Smith, said, leave that to those who handle it. You know, leave that to the psychiatrists and the analysts. We're alcoholics. That's what we are. And that's all we are. I picked up my first drink when I was 16 years old. I had graduated high school. I was now a mature woman in college. I had never dated. I had never gone out. I had never had a drink. I had never had a cigarette. I had never done drugs. I truly had not done anything. I went to a party one night, and we played, I hate to admit this because I was almost 16, we played Spin the Bottle. Now, I'm still playing Spin the Bottle at 16. This is the kind of home I came from. And that was like racy. You know, this was like, this was as close to sin as I got. And I kissed, somebody turned the lights off, and I was kissing this guy when the lights went off. Now, I don't remember what the kiss was like, except his lips were very salty, and it tasted good. I don't know if that means I was having, you know, some kind of a sexual thing going on, but it's salty lips. Walked in the house. My mom had been peering across the street into this house where the party was going on, and she said, did you have a good time? I said, oh, yeah, we played Spin the Bottle. She said, why were the lights out? I said, I don't know. I don't know who turned them out. I didn't turn them out. What were you doing? I said, I was kissing Franklin. Bam, across the room. Bam. What do you want to be? One of those women? I didn't even know what those women were. I was to find out very quickly. 3 months later, I graduated high school. I was in college, and I roomed with 7 other women. Not a very exclusive college. But here I'm in this little room with 7 women. There's a bunk beds in each corner. And they all drank, and they all smoked, and a couple of them even did some drugs, which at that time was kind of not even the thing to do, really. I hate to tell you. I'm going to end this conversation right now, but I'm 60 years old, and I'm going to tell you that because otherwise I'm going to tell you when I got sober, how old I was, and how long I'm sober, and you're all going to be sitting there. You're going to miss what I say anyway, thinking, okay, she's going to do it. I'm 60. Okay? We're finished with that now. Yeah. And I love being 60. I love being 60. I am the greatest 60-year-old you're ever going to see in your life. Ah, no conceit in my family. Anyway, I went away to college, and somebody said to me, you want a drink? I said, I've never had a drink. And they said, well, come on, we'll go down to the bar and have a drink. And I bellied up to that bar for the first time. And here I am, 5'8". I weighed about 108 pounds, soaking wet. I had long black hair. This is thanks to Clairol. Very long, very curly black hair that just went any way it wanted to go. And I looked around, and here were these adorable, absolutely adorable little 5'2", blonde, blue-eyed, cheerleader-type women. And God, I wanted to look, I wanted to feel the way they looked. They looked like, they were dancing and skipping and hollering and hooting, just having a great time. And I'm standing there thinking, oh, what am I going to have to drink? What am I going to have to drink? I mean, big decision, 16 years old, never in a bar. And the bartender said, what do you want, honey? And I said, well, I have a Manhattan. Don't ever. If you've never had one, don't go back out to try it. It's not worth it. And he said to me, well, how do you want that? Well, I thought that was the dumbest question I'd ever heard in my life. In a glass, of course. I mean, how else would you want it? I didn't. And I said that to him. You know, I just looked at him and all 5'8", soaking wet, and I said, in a glass, dear. And he laughed, just the way you laughed, and I thought that was stupid until I found out you can have Manhattan several different ways. So I had that first drink, and I didn't become 5'2", blonde, blue-eyed, and a cheerleader, but I just felt, I don't know, a little more comfortable. Just, I could kind of not stand up quite so straight. Just relax a little bit. The second drink, I was able to look at a guy and say, hi, I'm Pat, I'm new here, you know. The third drink, I looked down, and that guy who didn't look so good when I first walked in looked a hell of a lot better. Yeah, he just really, he looked more mature and more masculine and good. And the fifth drink, it started. I had never danced before, ever. Not with my mother, my sisters, no one. Not like a man, you know. It started. You know how you hear that rhythm and you just know you have it? Never done it, but you know you got it, man, boy. And I'm up there just clicking away, and the next thing I know, I was 5'2", blonde, blue-eyed, and a cheerleader with pom-poms. I was on a table, I can remember this, on a table dancing with a guy. You know, I didn't just dance on the dance floor, now I'm on a table dancing. And that was the beginning for me. If you could feel that way, just with that little brown liquid, why would you ever stop? Why would you ever stop? I wasn't depressed. I wasn't mentally ill. I wasn't any of this. I was just a 16-year-old who wanted to grow up faster than she could. And boy, booze did it for me. It started to make me everything I wanted to be. I managed to crawl up to the dormitory that night, and I got into the college, and we had house mothers at that time. Now, those of you who come from my generation know a house mother waits at the door and checks everybody in. Now, I'm on my knees coming in. And I heard a lecture about the evils of alcohol. And I had another word for this house mother that night that I won't repeat here. But I got put to bed, and my parents spent a lot of money for this. This is what I learned the almost first year of my college education, was that if you started to spin after drinking, put one foot on the floor. It would help stop the room from spinning. And that didn't always work, but it was good information. I mean, it cost them several thousand dollars, but what the hell? That was pretty good information. I was to transfer 4 times before I finally graduated, but I did graduate at 19, and I still am not too sure how I did that. But I was in a rush. I was in a rush to get involved in life. I wanted to be out there where things were happening and people were doing stuff, and I could be a part of it. And I got into some trouble in college. A little trouble. I got pregnant. I guess that's a little trouble. And I went home, and I was to lose that baby, and that was the pattern for me. I could never seem to carry children, but I was not upset that I lost that first one because I was only 17, and it was a bit of a shock. And so when I didn't carry it, it was kind of a blessing, and I went to another college, and I got in a little trouble there. Not pregnant that time, but a little trouble. And I transferred back to the college I left, and I transferred out, and I transferred back. And it was like I never knew which college I was going to graduate from. But I finally graduated, and I became a school teacher. And they put me in first grade, and I was really angry. I didn't want to be in first grade. I had a certificate that said I could teach first to sixth, and of course I wanted to be all the way at the other end of sixth grade, and they put me in first grade. And I'm playing this little game with the kids one day, duck, duck, goose. And I'm going around tapping on the little kids, going duck, 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 and I tapped a little girl, and I called her goose, and she's got to chase me around the circle. Now, I'm competitive. I won't let my grandmother win. So this little tiny tot is running after me, and I'm 19 years old, and bam, I'm around that circle, I'm back in the space, and I'm down. And she looks down at me, and she says, "Phew, you run good for your age." Now, I knew I had to get out of that first grade, you know. This is not for me. So I moved up to sixth grade right away. The year ended, I put in an application, and I got a sixth grade class. And I was to teach sixth grade for 13 years, actually 15, 13 of which were wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. The last two, I should not have been a teacher. I loved those kids. I absolutely loved them. I got along with them. I realized today the reason I got along with them emotionally, I was the same age. You know, we just, hey, it was fun. They were great kids. I didn't like their parents a whole heck of a lot. I didn't like the other teachers very much. I didn't like the system very much, but I loved the kids. I just loved them. And I was a good teacher. I'm proud of that, except for the last 2 years. I was asked to do a demonstration lesson. I'm putting this in only because it became a major part of my life. I was doing a lot of weekend drinking, but as a teacher, I knew I couldn't be seen anywhere near the school drinking. I couldn't go into a bar. I mean, there's a lot of things teachers couldn't do back then that they get away with today. And I was to do this lesson, and I said to my principal, "I can't do it. I just can't do it. I'm too nervous. I'm going to throw up. I'm going to pass out. Whatever, I can't do it." She said, "Don't worry, honey." And she reached into her purse and popped a little top off a thing and put 2 green capsules in my hand. And she said, "Just take these." And I looked at them and I said, "Thank you," and I left. But I had a dilemma. She gave me those on Monday. I had to do the demonstration on Friday. Now, I don't know if these two were going to work on Friday. So I took them on Monday. And they were pretty good. For those of you who are around, they're Librium, the precursor to Valium. So I took two Librium. Now I had another dilemma. How would I get two more for Friday? So I said to her, how did you get these? She said, oh, honey, you'll never get them. I'm in menopause, and you're only 21. So I went to the library, and I got a medical book, and I opened to menopause, and I read all the symptoms, and I wrote them down, and I studied them for about an hour until I had most of them memorized. I called her doctor, who was a female doctor, made an emergency appointment to see her, sat in front of this woman, and said, now, I know you're not going to believe this. I know it. She said, well, honey, just tell me what it is. Well, I know you're not going to believe it. She said, just tell me. You know, let me make a decision. And I told her, I think I'm in menopause. And she said, oh, darling. I said, see, I knew you wouldn't believe it. I just knew you wouldn't believe it. She said, well, tell me what's wrong. And I didn't give her all the symptoms. I mean, that would have been dumb. You know, she would have known I'd just gotten a book. But I gave her enough. And she said, oh, my God, you're one in a million. And she whipped out that pad, and she wrote that little prescription, and my dilemma was solved. Unfortunately, that became a habit. That became a way of life. I drank on the weekends, drugged during the week. And it was all legal prescription drugs until I ended up shopping in your medicine chest on a regular basis. Every time I went to visit, it was like in the bathroom, open the medicine chest, and it was like a mini mall. You know, you look at federal law prohibits, oh, they look good. And I always left you two. I never took them all because I was a good person, see. And if you ever had an attack, I didn't want you to die because then I'd be guilty. So I just left you some and I took them. And I was eventually end up taking my dog's drugs, which when I told somebody in AA, they said, well, honey, you know, anybody that pops their pooch's pills, that's not normal. So I can see where this alcoholic has to stay, and I share this with you because it could have killed me. It could have killed me. If I hadn't faced that in sobriety, I could be dead today. And I'm not telling you what to do with your life. I'm only sharing what happened with my life. And for me, this alcoholic has to stay totally substance-free, totally, or I'm not really sober for me. Now, I don't know what you're going to do, but that's for me. And if you're sitting out there struggling with it, understand that you can do it because I've done it. I was never in a rush to get married. I was in a rush to be involved. See, I like men, along with booze. And the more I drank, the more I liked. In fact, God, I liked a lot of them. But I always wanted to be with this one guy. He was the brother of one of my best friends. And every weekend for 3 years, I went to Mount Snow, Vermont to ski. And I looked good. God, did I look good. I had those tight ski pants and the tight racer jackets, not with the big furry collars, because they're like for the people who don't really know how to ski. I look good. You kept it open. You had the buckles open on the boots and just kind of flopped around all weekend long. Never put those things on the bottom of my feet because you could get killed with those. But I looked good, man. I looked like a hip-looking cool skier. 3 years, every weekend from New York City to Mount Snow, Vermont and back again, drunk all the time. Driving drunk, spending the whole weekend drunk, and coming home drunk. And one weekend, Charlie said to me, hey, Pat, want to go skiing with me? Ah, I had Charlie. I mean, he wanted me for a whole weekend. This was like a long-term relationship. So off we go. Now, I don't know how to ski, so I went to my friend's house. She taught me how to ski in her living room. On a Thursday night, I took her skis and her poles, put on my nice, hips-looking, cool outfit, got in the car with Charlie. We drank vodka from New York City to Mount Snow, Vermont. We got there, and it's a blizzard. I mean, it's snowing, and it's cold, and the wind's blowing. He says to me, honey, what slope you want to go on? I said, anyone you want, darling. Charlie was an advanced slope skier. So into this little chair we get that I have never experienced in my life, and we're going up. Now, not only do I not know how to ski, but I'm afraid of heights. Now, this thing is going up and up and up. And Charlie's skis are kind of hanging out right in front of him where they should be. And mine are kind of like drifting. They're kind of like one is going out that way and one's going out that way. And then they're both hanging down and then they're up in front of my face. And I'm like really panicked. But I'm still pretty high, you know. And it's like, okay, no big deal. We're going to ski. I got to the top of the mountain, and God granted me one of those wonderful moments of clarity. Wonderful. Tell Charlie you can't ski. So I looked at Cheryl. I said, I don't know how to tell you this, baby, but I don't know how to ski. Now, this is going to be the love of my life for a whole weekend. And he says to me, well, the only way down, babe, is this way. Puts his poles in that snow and pushes off. And I'm up there, and the wind's blowing, and the snow is coming down, and I'm freezing, and I'm scared. And I said to God, who I did not understand, nor did I wish to, God, you know what's coming. God, if you get me off this mountain, I'll never do this again. And I put those poles in that snow, and I pushed off, and I'm following Charlie down that mountain. And I'm screaming. I'm in Vermont. You could have heard me in Massachusetts. Everybody's getting out of the way, because here comes Pat, plowing down that mountain. Now, I tell you this, because at the bottom of that mountain, most normal people, whoever they are, normal people would get on their knees and say, thank you, God. You saved my life. I will never do that again. I got to the bottom of that mountain, planted those poles in the snow, leaned back on one of them and said, you're a natural skier. You know, a couple more runs, you could be in the Olympics. Because my head told me a lie and I would believe it. That's how I drank. My head told me a lot of stuff that became reality for me. You know, hey, you're having a good time, aren't you? Sure I am. Oh, great, okay, it's not dangerous. Good, you're having a good time. I believe that. I would believe what I told myself. When I got sober, I'm getting ahead of myself, because I'm a long way from sober, but not today. Anyway, I didn't see Charlie anymore after that weekend. He just plopped me on that bar stool and left me alone, put some money in front of me, and he went about his business. But it did something for me. See, as long as alcohol was doing something for me, why would I even think that it was a problem? It got me into the group that I always wanted to belong to, the advanced slope skiers. 3 more years to Mount Snow, never put those dumb wooden things on the bottom of my feet again. But every time somebody said to me, you want to go down the slope? I'd say, no thanks, just came off the North Face and I'm not going down again today, I'm tired. Hey, it was 3 years before, who cared? But I wasn't lying. I had gone down the north face of the mountain. I ended up in, I guess it was Spring Lake, New Jersey, one weekend in the summer. Because I went from Mount Snow, Vermont to Spring Lake, New Jersey. I would never stay in Manhattan. Now, everybody loves to visit Manhattan. I'm running away. I'm running to the mountains or to the seashore. Got a great home in Manhattan. I'm running. And I went to Spring Lake, and I met my first ex-husband. Oh, he was gorgeous. He was an unemployed bartender with no place to live. Just what I was looking for, man. I was going to change him and clean him up and fix him and just give him a life he never expected. And so I took him home. And I did. I bought him clothes. I bought him a little car. I have 2 sisters. One of them is a lot like me. She's just a year and a half younger. And she's a little left of center. She doesn't drink, but she's just not wrapped too tight. And she knows that. I talk to her about it. They listen to my tapes. And my other sister, some of you may have a sister or a brother or a relative like this. She's perfect. Oh, God, is she perfect. Anyway, she's exactly 14 months older than I. And my mom and dad always wanted us to do certain things at certain times of our lives, and she did them all. She married at the right time. She's Irish, Italian, Greek, Roman Catholic, just like me. And she married an Irish-Danish man, and now they had 5 Irish, Italian, Greek, Danish, Roman Catholic little babies. And then she adopted a beautiful Korean child during the Korean airlift. And so now they had 6 beautiful children in a beautiful house with a little white picket fence around it and the burgundy curtains and a dog that was perfect and a cat that was perfect. You know, when you knock on the door and the damn dog barks once perfectly, that's the kind of life she lived. And I used to make fun of her. I used to ridicule her. Like, who would want that kind of a life, taking care of all those kids? It's so much responsibility, and taking care of that husband and cooking and cleaning and doing all that stuff. And I realized today the reason I made fun of her is because I wanted to be her. I wanted that home with those kids. I wanted that nice life. But I was a drunk. You know, I was too busy following that yellow, wet road to inebriation. And I couldn't stop. I didn't know how to stop. I didn't know how to become her. I had no clue on how to become her. But I wanted to be her. And so I would just ridicule her. And to her face, I would go there and just be obnoxious and rude and mean. Well, when I married this unemployed bartender with no place to live, I decided I'd be her. He's not working, but I started ironing his shirts. I don't know where he's going, but I'm busy ironing shirts. And I decided I'd cook. Now, I hadn't even known how to turn on my oven until this point. I dust my kitchen today. It's the nicest room in my house. I walk around with a little dust cloth, and it's so gorgeous. I open my oven so you can look at it. I just leave it open so people can see how clean it is, what a nice housekeeper I am, because I still don't cook. But I decided I'd cook. And I bought a recipe book with pictures, and I bought most of the ingredients. I couldn't find all of them, but I found a lot. You know, it seemed like good enough to me. And with a bottle of scotch here, and ingredients here, and a book here, I'm ready to cook, man. I'm now Julia Childs in my own kitchen. And I'm looking at that picture, and I'm reading those directions, a little bit of this, and a little bit of this, and a little bit of this, and maybe a little bit more of this. By the time I finished that, it didn't look anything like that picture. I was so drunk, I could have cared less. And that son of a gun wouldn't eat it. Now, he didn't have a sense of humor, you know, just so it didn't look like the picture. It's no big deal. So it's a little burned. Well, it's a whole lot burned, but, you know, come on. You could have tasted it. And I'm busy ironing shorts and handkerchiefs and shirts. And I'm busy teaching, and he's busy hanging out. And we're going out at night, hustling pool. And I became a pretty good pool player. And he was an excellent pool player. We had nothing else to do all day long. You know, shot pool, boom, 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 boom. So we hustled pool. We made a lot of money at it. And I made a decision that, okay, I couldn't really cook, and I couldn't really clean, and I couldn't really iron shirts, but I would be faithful. I would never cheat on him. Well, let me tell you, that lasted about 3 months. And I was in the bar one night, and he was shooting pool, trying to set up some guy to hustle pool. And there was this other guy at the other end who looked awful good. And he really didn't look good when I looked at him later on, but he looked good at that moment. And we left. I mean, we left. And when I did that, I knew I didn't want to be there anymore. I knew I didn't want to be there anymore. I wanted out because I was a failure again. See, and if I fail, I run. I can't hang around if I'm a failure. And I was a failure. I was a failure as a wife. I couldn't even be a wife. I couldn't be like my sister. So I wanted him out. And I found an excuse to get him out one day because I came home from minor surgery in the hospital. And I found a cigarette in the ashtray next to my side of the bed that was not my brand and it had lipstick on. So I went around telling everybody I found him in bed with somebody else. Well, hey, I figured that out all by myself. And I even carried that into sobriety. I didn't get honest about that till I was 2 years sober, standing at a podium just like this with a lot fewer people, telling them about what my husband did to me. And I'm saying that I found him in bed with this woman. I said, whoa, wait a minute. That's not the truth. I found a cigarette on my side of the bed with lipstick on it, and I decided he had had an affair. So I called my Italian-Greek father. There had never been a divorce in 37 centuries in my family. And I'm about to create one. So I didn't know how to do this. So I get on the phone. I could cry real easy to my father. I was the son he never had, and I could just manipulate the hell out of him. And so I got on the phone to him, and I started to cry about what this man did to me. Now, my father said these words, just get rid of him. Now, Mary Pearl described what she tried to do, but my father did not mean what I was about to try to do. I came back into that room that he was in, and I said, my father said, you have to die. And I had the weapon to do it with. And that lousy guy ducked. He ducked. And I told him, well, now you got 40 minutes to get out of here. He was gone in 10. 10 minutes, everything, lock, stock, and barrel, all his clothes, everything. And he was gone. He left Florida. By that time, I was living in Florida. No, I was living in New York. And I decided New York was my problem. I had to get away from New York, so I did move to Florida then. I had been pensioned off at teaching because I fell at work. And I always said it never happened because I was drunk, but it did happen because I was drunk. And I will always regret that because I loved that job. It was an accomplishment for me. I loved the kids. And I moved to Florida, and everything was going to be different. Well, let me tell you, it's different. It's different when you run away. Because now I had no friends. I had no contacts. I found a wonderful bar in Florida. I walked into a restaurant. The maitre d' said, we're a little busy. Mind waiting in the bar? And I said, no problem. You know, where else would I want to wait? And then I go, and the bartender's over there, and I'm oohing and ahhing, look at that, look at this, look at this. The bartender said, what do you want? And I turned around, it's the ex-husband. He's standing right there in that bar. The I mean, it's a big country to walk into your ex-husband in the middle of a state you didn't know he was in. And he said, "Do you think we can get back together?" Never. And you know, I wanted to get even with him for whatever I thought he did. So he was traveling with this guy, George. So I decided I would marry George. And George and I got engaged. I mean, very quickly. It worked out real well according to Pat's plan. And he's, George is drinking, I'm drinking, Evan's drinking. We're all drinking, you know, in the same place. And Evan's trying to get me back, and I'm trying to get George to get even with Evan. And it's wonderful, a very healthy situation. Anyway, I flew to New York to get my divorce papers because they were in a safe deposit box back there. And a friend of mine met me at the airport, and she says, "How you doing?" I said, "Oh, wonderful. I'm in love. I'm getting married as soon as I get back. We even bought a kitchen set. I don't know why we bought a kitchen set. I can't cook. But we bought a kitchen set, the only piece of furniture we now had, which we wouldn't use." And now she says to me, "What's his name?" I said, "George." She said, "What's his last name?" That's just how I stood there looking at her like, I haven't a clue. I never thought to ask. I mean, I wasn't interested in George. I was getting even with Evan. You know, I was just getting even. And I realized today I never got even. I always got worse. Whatever you did, I went one step below you. I can be vicious. Just vicious. Anyway, I flew back to Florida, told George the wedding was off. I didn't tell him why. I didn't tell him I didn't know his last name, and that would kind of cut it. And I proceeded to drink my way down to oblivion. I now became that drunk that some of you have come to know and love, and some of you guys talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat in a bar where there were 20 bar stools. There was a front door and a back door, and it was not a bar where you went to drink, rather went to dance or sing or converse. It had one of those cracked mirrors in the back where you just sit there and look in the mirror and pick out all the other drunks in the bar, but you can't see your own face. I sat in that bar for 4 years. I was there when the door opened, and I was there when the door locked. Every single day. Every once in a while, I'd run down the street to shoot some pool in a place called the Sawdust Trail. Now, this was the big spot for me, the Sawdust Trail, this kid from Manhattan, this kid who had gone to college and taught school, and I'm shooting pool in the Sawdust Trail, and I was thrown out of it. I was thrown out of it, and I thought, how dare they? Don't they know who I am? And I can remember sitting in that bar that I called home and looking down that bar and say, oh, my God, if I ever use language like he does, I'm going to do something. I did. I picked up all the words he used, and I used them, and I even embellished on them. I added a few of my own. And then I'd look down the bar, and I see somebody just plastered, hanging off the railing, and I said, oh, God, if I ever look like that, absolutely going to do something. I never said I'd stop drinking, but I knew I could not stop drinking. There was no doubt in my mind that that was not an option. I had tried about 3 years before because I started to shake big time. And I went to a patio bar and they poured a drink for me in a small glass. Now, I don't know why a drunk thinks that this shaking hand can be stopped by this shaking hand. But I grabbed this hand to get that thing off the bar and it was still shaking. So I did what any good drunk will do in the middle of a big outside patio bar with a lot of tourists who looked absolutely gorgeous and clean. I leaned over and lapped that booze out of that little glass like an animal. And I made a decision that day I would never run out of booze because that's the solution. It's the only solution I had. So that day in that bar, when I looked down, I saw this woman at the end of the bar and I said, oh my God, if I ever get like her, I'll have to do something. And one day I turned around and she was gone. And I was her. You guys know her. You remember her. The kind of, you know, you remember when we walk in and you say, oh, God, look at her. And then, you know, two or three drinks later you say, well, you know, she's not so bad. Come on, she's not so bad. Two or three more drinks, it's like, actually, she's kind of cute. And then five or six more drinks, it's like, hey, honey, you want to go home? You remember the girl that you rolled over, the woman when you rolled over, you said, oh, my God, who's she? Well, let me tell you, Joe, almost for every guy that's rolled this way, there's been a woman who's rolled this way. And the response she's going to come out with is, oh, my God, who's he? I didn't go with you because I loved you. I didn't go with you because I wanted sex with you. I went with you because I was afraid to be alone. I hated me, and I didn't know what to do. We may have had sex, we may not have. Most of the times I wouldn't have remembered. So it mustn't have been all that good. I don't know. But I hated who I was, and I didn't know what to do. A friend of mine asked me to manage his motel for him, and I don't know why he asked me, because I was a full-blown, falling down, one step away from Skid Row. I had a room I called home. I started off drinking in Florida with a little brown poodle. And I remember somewhere down the line, that little poodle was gone, and I had a white dog. Now, I don't know how that happened. I remember one day looking down at that dog and saying, "You're white. Where'd that little brown dog go?" And it just bothered me for about a half hour. You know, So here I am, this atrocious-looking thing, and I went to work in this motel, and he said to me, "Now, if you need help, here's a list of some names of people who would like to work here." Well, they had one of those plug-in switchboards, you know, where you plug the wire in, and then when they finish, you pull it out, and you plug some over here. And I had like 30 plug-ins one day, and I just got bored of figuring out who was off and who was on. I pulled them all. Just disconnected everybody. Everybody came running in. I mean, there's people paying a lot of money to be in Florida for vacation. I was disconnected. I said, "It must be the phone company." Now, every wire is hanging out of that thing. Nobody's online. So I called the first name on the list, the very first name on the list. Her name was Joanne, and Joanne came to the motel, and I had beer cans all over and a bottle of scotch hidden underneath because I only had a little bit left, and God forbid you don't get that, man. I'll give you a beer, but I won't give you my scotch. And she walked in, and I said, "Hey, honey, you want a drink?" She says, "No, thank you. I used to drink just like you, and I don't drink anymore." Who needed her, you know? I did. I was afraid to call the next one because I might not get her, so I hired her. And every day she'd come in, and she'd say to me, "How you doing?" Bright, cheery, smiling, laughing. I wanted to throw up. And every day she'd say, "I'm really not interested in drinking," because I'd always offer another drink. And she'd say, "No, honestly, I don't drink anymore." Well, I was to be thrown out of that motel, and she stayed on. And about 8 months later, on December 31st, 1974, I was sitting in this room. I called home, a bed with no sheets on it, filthy dirty, this poor little white dog that went drinking with me all the time. You know, "Give me a drink, give the dog a drink." And I remember saying, "Oh, God, I'm not going out tonight. It's New Year's Eve. It's amateur night." Yeah. And about 9:30, 10 o'clock, I looked at the clock and I said, "Well, I can't stay here." And that's the very last conscious thought I had for 6 days. No idea where I went, no idea who I was with or what I did, and I'm very grateful that it's never come back to me because I'm sure I'd rather not know. I'm sure that whatever I did was not pleasant because what I had been doing for three, four years now was not pleasant. And I came to in this bed, which was a miracle in itself, which I had left 6 days before. I have canceled checks from all over town. Sold a car. I had an Austin Healey Mark III 3000. Sold it during that time for $250. Totally restored. Totally, it's the only thing of value, money-wise value, that I had. Sold it for $250 to somebody. I saw it when I got sober. I wanted to kill him. So I'm driving down the street, and I want to run him off the road. And today I'm grateful he bought it because it was part of that that helped to get me sober. Everything that happened to me out there is why I'm standing here. And I don't want any part of it to ever be changed. I will never regret anything I did. I'm not proud of some of the stuff I did, but I don't regret it. I don't regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. I don't regret it. Even some of the stuff I'm not proud of. Anyway, I woke up that morning, filthy dirty, short hair on one side, long hair on the other side. I started to cut it with a little tiny cuticle scissor. My arm got tired, and I just stopped. And this was before punk was in, so this is, you know, like a little weird. And there I am. I'm going into the bathroom, and there's this mirror right next to the bathroom. And a lot of you have had this experience with mirrors. And I stopped. And for the first time in years, I looked at who I had become. I could finally see my face in the mirror. Even if I couldn't see it in that bar room, I saw me in the mirror. And I remember saying, "God, help me. Just help me." And I don't hear voices. I have never heard God's voice, and I don't hear, although I did used to hear, "Love is a many splendid thing and amazing grace," from my air conditioner. Whether it was on or off, it just would, I mean, I would just be sitting around, and all of a sudden it would play, and I never knew which one it was going to play, and it could be on or off. It didn't matter. So it was kind of interesting, you know, in the middle of company, I'd say, "Wait a minute, I want to hear what's playing," and they weren't hearing anything, but I'm hearing something. But that day, Her words came back to me, not in sound. I just remembered exactly what she said, only this time I remembered it not as I heard it, but as I'm sure she said it. I used to drink just like you, and I don't drink anymore. And I said, oh my God, she's got a solution. I didn't use those words, but I said, oh my God, she knows what to do. And I poured what says, thank you, God, to this day has been my last drink, into the glass, which sat next to the bottle, which sat next to the bed. Because, see, I wouldn't drink out of a bottle. That's what alcoholics did. Yeah. So I always poured it in the dirty glass. She didn't have to clean the glass because alcohol is, you know, antiseptic, so it cleans germs. So I just poured it into that dirty glass, got in the car, and drove drunk one more time. One more time. And I went to that motel, and she was there. Oh, thank you, God, she was there. Walked in and said, for the first time in my 38 years, Joanne, I need help. I can't stop drinking. Now I'm ready to die. I mean, I'm 245 pounds. I've got on a yellow blouse that has 8 buttonholes and 3 buttons. I've got a big pin in the side. I couldn't even see what my shoes were like. I am filthy dirty with short hair and long hair. She jumps about 3 feet into the air. She's laughing and screaming, and now she's calling some woman from another room. Patty, come in here, come in here, look what we've got. And like, these two little shrimpy girls, you know, are just jumping around, holding each other, laughing and crying and giggling. And I'm crying, man, I'm crying, because don't they realize how serious this is? They sat me in a chair, and the line began. I heard them on the phone. They're calling up all these people. There must have been 30 AA members that just kind of filed past and took a look at the drunk. Hey, hon, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just knew she didn't drink anymore. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, hey, come on. But I know I kept a lot of people sober that day. Boy, did I keep a lot of people sober that day. I didn't know I was doing that. I was really passing it on, let me tell you. And all of a sudden, this guy is standing in front of me. And John had sat next to me for at least 2 years in that bar on the stool next to mine, and I thought John had died. 3 years ago, John just didn't show up. Now, I thought about that probably for a half hour, too, and discounted it and didn't worry about it, but I figured, oh, John died. John's standing in front of me. And I said to him, John, where have you been? He said, I've been sober at Alcoholics Anonymous for 3 years. I said, I can't believe it. He said, I can't believe you're alive. He said, you drank just like I did. I can't believe you survived for another 3 years. And John became a vision of hope for me. Because, God, if John could do it, I could do it. Just maybe I could do it. They took me to a meeting. Now I'm vibrating. I'm not just detoxing. I'm vibrating from Valium and all your drugs and all my dog's drugs and the dog's drugs and booze. And geez, I'm sitting there just coming unglued. And everybody's telling me how long they're sober. And this woman comes up and she says, hi, I'm Rosemary, and I've got 5 years. And I smiled at her, and I said, oh, that's very nice. Rosemary walked away, and my head said, where's David? He doesn't like four-letter words, so this is 5 letters. Lying bitch. Nobody stays sober for 5 years. And then this big, tall, red-headed girl ran across the room at me. Now, it wasn't really a big room, but I'm detoxing big time, so it looked big, and she looked like she was coming full speed, and she stopped dead in front of me, and she said, hi, I'm Maureen, and I have almost 2 months sober. And man, Maureen was a vision of hope. Maybe I could get that. I don't know how I thought I would get it. I couldn't go one day without a drink, but maybe I could do what Maureen did. And that night, they all talked about how this program worked for them. I didn't hear a word they said. I just kept watching that clock slowly, slowly tick off seconds. And I couldn't wait to get out of that room. And at the end of the meeting, a man got up and he said, honey, everybody shared with you tonight and it doesn't mean anything to you. Just don't drink. Go to meetings and get a sponsor. And he walked over and he put his arms around me. Be dirty. I'm reeking of vodka and assorted other odors. I've got short hair on one side and long hair on the other. And he put his arms around me and he said, we love you. Keep coming back. We need you. Man, I couldn't understand that. I couldn't understand that. How could he say that to me? How could they need me? I had nothing to offer them. And so I went home that night and I started to big time detox. Actually, the women took me to the motel and I detoxed in that room. And I guess they didn't know any more about detoxing than I knew, because I know I did have seizures during that time, and they prayed a lot over my body as I was having them. And I guess God was there, because I got through. I got through. And it was the toughest time of my life. And I never have to do it again. Ever. If you get sober once, you never have to do it again. I was told that. So see, I used to listen to people talk about going back out. And one day, I got an Agnes as my sponsor on a Saturday. I got sober on a Monday, but these little women told me I had to have a sponsor by Saturday, by the end of the week. And so I went to the meeting, and I walked in, and there was this wonderful, wonderful looking woman. And I walked up to her, and I said, "Can you be my sponsor?" And she looked at me, said, "Oh, no, honey, I can't." And I said, "Oh, all right." She said, "I'm an Al-Anon." And I said, "What the hell is that?" That must be worse than alcoholic, because I haven't heard anybody mention it. So I went to the very next lady, because I was going to have a sponsor. You know, I hear people say, well, go to meetings, listen to what they say, and if you hear what, you know, what something really good about the steps, get a sponsor. I would have been 32 years sober waiting to hear somebody say something about the steps until I got into them. I didn't know it was good or not good. I didn't know if you had good sobriety or bad sobriety or average sobriety. I didn't know. How could I know until I started taking them? You know, I didn't know what you were saying was good. So I asked this lady, would you be my sponsor? She jumped up, put her arm around me, said, "You bet I will," and I got a drill sergeant. She was wonderful. Agnes loved me when I couldn't love myself. She really became that power greater than myself. I spelled God that way. A-G-N-E-S. She was wonderful. She took time out of her life for me. I would call her in the middle of the night, and I'd say, "Agnes, I'm going crazy. I'm just going crazy. I can't spend another night. I'm going crazy." She'd get in the tub. Now, I don't know how that computes, but, you know, get in the tub. I'm not dirty. I'm just crazy. She said, "Get in the tub, honey. Just get in the tub. Go fill the tub, get in the tub, and call me back, and, you know, we'll talk about it more." Well, I would fill the tub, get in one end, get out the other end, get back on the phone. Agnes, I did that. Now I should get back in the tub. I got in and out of tubs for the first year of my sobriety. Every night I'm in the damn tub. She bought me a timer. I had to set the timer for 30 minutes. You ever try and sit in a tub full of water and relax when you're strung out? It's like, looking at the timer and it's not moving. And you get out and you're like, your skin's falling off your body, it's so wet. And you get back on the phone and you say, "Agnes, I'm finished, get back in the tub." But you know, I didn't go crazy. I didn't go crazy and I was very clean. I was probably the cleanest member of Alcoholics Anonymous for at least 6 months. I mean, I walked into meetings and everybody said, "Boy, you're clean." I didn't know much about the steps or anything else, because I was very sick for the first year. I guess we talked about the steps, but I could read the big book, and I could read one paragraph, and then I could go back and read the same paragraph, and the same paragraph, and the same paragraph, and close the book, and if you gave me a test on that paragraph, I would have failed, because I had no idea what it was saying. And I'm a school teacher. I should know what it says in a simple book. I didn't know. I was absolutely dumb about this whole thing. So I think Agnes walked me through a lot of steps rather than putting me through any structured program. And she had asked me to please do one thing for her, considering my lifestyle, to please remain away from men for a year. So I was going to be the best AA pigeon God ever created. And so every time a man even came within 30 feet of me, I moved. I was the most mobile person you ever saw in your life. I mean, I was sitting here. I was sitting there. I was in the ladies' room. I was out of the ladies' room. Back over there. Back. There's a lot of men in AA, and they're not always after me, but I thought they were, man. I thought every guy in AA was after the bod. It was 6 days before my first anniversary. I walked into this 101 club where I'd gotten sober, and there was a dance going on, and I was all dressed up, and I looked good, man. I had lost lots of weight. I'd gone to the beauty parlor, and I would not let them tease my hair, because I hated teased hair, and I looked good, and I knew I looked good, and I didn't know much about God's will, but I found out a lot about it that night, man. He was sitting about 8 rows back, and I knew instantly it was God's will for me to go get him.
Because I felt, I mean, you know what that's, it's like, boom, there's God's will. Okay, here we go. Now let me tell you why it was God's will, see. His last name was Murphy. And I had been invited to a party where her last name was Murphy. And she was going to marry this other guy whose name would shortly be Murphy. And her dog's name was Murphy. So I knew we were going to get married. Now, I could have a relationship without ever dating you. You know that. I can name children and everything without ever having gone out with you. Just looking at you, I can say, oh, okay, we'll go together for like 6 months. We'll get married. We'll have our first son and we'll name him such and such. Not even gone out yet. But I know exactly what's right in my life. And I knew Mr. Wonderful was God's will. And so he never asked me to move in. But he would ask me out, and I'd say, sure, Bob, I'll meet you at your place. He said, no, I'll pick you up. He said, no, it's easy for me to come over here. It's near the club. So I'd bring three outfits, one to wear and two to store. And before 2.5 weeks was up, I had all my clothes in his closet. He never asked me to move in. Never. But all of a sudden, he turned around. He had a living lover, and here I was. Because I wanted what he had. See, I was really insecure. I was really scared of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought if I could get a guy who had 5 or 6 years sober, I could have what he had. And he looked good. He was a nice guy. He was really a nice guy. He had 6 years sober. He had a lot of friends. He was very active. He was general service rep. I mean, he was everything I wasn't. And I thought, well, I can be Mrs. Bob Murphy. And I got pregnant again. This was for like the fourth time, but now this time I was going to have that baby. I could be my sister because I'm sober and I can have this wonderful life. And I carried that baby till I was seven months along and lost it. And I was devastated. And so, of course, I went back to blaming God and you and the whole world. And Bob and I, we were together for about 4 or 5 years. We had a good time. We sponsored. We went to meetings. We were active in the fellowship and in the program. And we were both in general service. And we were like Mr. and Mrs. AA. It was just adorable. I mean, it was just adorable. And when I was 6 years sober, I got cancer. I got breast cancer. I found a lump when I was taking a shower. Went to the doctor. He said, well, I'm not sure, but let's go in the hospital. And the morning of the surgery, the night before the surgery, I was really afraid. And I can remember sitting there thinking, oh, God, I just want to run. Because, see, when I got scared, I ran. I was a wonderful runner. And here I am 6 years sober, and I wanted to run again. And I got this thing about just pick up the big book. So I did, and I opened it up. And it just happened to open to step three. And so I read step three in the big book, closed the book, got into bed, and fell sound asleep. Sound asleep. They shook me awake at 6 in the morning. And as my eyes opened, I looked at seven women standing around my bed. Six from Alcoholics Anonymous and one from Al-Anon. It was John's wife. You know, John, who used to drink with me. Thank God I never did anything with John, or at least that either of us could remember. Because she was to become one of my best friends, and still is. And there's Jerry and these other six women. And we laughed together, and we just had a wonderful time because I wasn't scheduled till 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I went in, and I had radical surgery and came out. And it was tough. It was just tough because I was just scared. And my program wasn't bad. It was all I needed for what I had to face. But now I needed more. Now I needed more. That's all. At first, I thought, God, you're never going to get this. You're never going to get well. But all I needed was more. Those women loved me when I couldn't love myself, just like Agnes did. And every time I'd start to think about just one, I never said what it was I wanted, but I would say to God, can I just have one? Just one. The phone would ring. See, that's one of those damn women. I'm telling her we're going to a meeting. Oh, no, I can't go to a meeting. See, I just had cancer. Oh, we know. We were there. No, but you don't understand. He left, because he did. He walked out on Thanksgiving Eve. The eve of his 12th anniversary, and he left because he couldn't handle it. And so I had all these excuses to feel sorry for myself, and these women were always there, always. They dragged me to meetings. They dragged me shopping. They dragged me wherever they were going. They didn't want to leave me alone because I really was dangerous to myself. This one girl came over. We called her Barefoot Barbara. You can't imagine why. Anyway, Barefoot Barbara came over, and she started mowing my lawn. And I called my sponsor. I said, Tommy, Barbara's mowing my lawn. She said, that's nice. I said, no, you don't understand. What do I do for her? She said, well, thank you would be nice. A cup of coffee would be. I said, no. How do I pay her back? The way I always live. I'm reverting right back to the way I used to live when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything was a payback. You could not do for me if I couldn't do for you. Couldn't. And she said, how about you pass it on? How about someday you do for someone else what she's doing for you today? And that made sense to me. I got back to the basics of the program. I got back to the simplicity of the program. A day at a time, just don't drink. Keep going to meetings. Talk to your sponsor. Help others. That's the basics for me. And I had become Mrs. AA with this Mr. AA who was now gone out of my life. And I would go to meetings. Now remember, he's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to meetings and somebody say, how you doing? I say, I don't want anybody to take sides, but let me tell you what the bastard did. And I tell them, and of course it was 600 for Pat and 2 for Bob. You know, and I was doing that on a regular basis. So my sponsor said, you do know you will have to make amends to him someday. Well, I stopped doing that right away. I may have thought of doing it, but I didn't do it anymore. I didn't want to make amends to him. But I was to make amends to him, and I'm very grateful that I did. He died of cancer about 4 years after I found out I was free of cancer. I was to have a second mastectomy 7 years after the first, and 4 years later he died. He died of throat cancer because he dipped snuff, just stuck it in there all the time, and his whole face was gone. He died a horrible death. I didn't see him, but we were friends. We were friends before he died, and I'm so grateful to this program because I swore I would never let him in my life. Never would I care for him again. I didn't care for him as an ex-husband. I didn't care for him as anything but another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was enough. That was more than enough. I had a spiritual experience when I was 6 months sober. It was wonderful. It was cataclysmic, and it wasn't enough. If I lived on that, I wouldn't be who I am today. I had to have a daily experience with God. I couldn't have just one. I had to work at this one day at a time. I thought I could walk on water after that experience because God had touched me, and I really believe he had. But it wasn't good for the next day or the next day or the next year or the next month, whatever. I had to do this just like you do it, one day at a time, and to find God as I understand him. And today the power greater than myself is not Eve, and it's not Agnes, it's God. God is, I personally understand God, and this God is close to me. I went to casinos, I went to retreats, I went to Baptist church, because I was afraid the Catholics wouldn't let me in. So I went to Baptist church, because I was going to find God. Well, it may be there for them, but it wasn't there for me. And it was only when I really, I don't know why, I read page 55 300 times, but I never read it. Until one day I read it, and I stopped running, and I sat still, and God was right there where you told me he'd be, deep down inside of me. And I tell you, I have the greatest relationship with God today. We talk all day long. Now, I drive the car, and I usually keep the windows up because I'm talking to God. And it gets a little hairy, you know. Sometimes I'm screaming at him, sometimes I'm laughing with him, but I'm talking to him all the time. The other day I was speeding down the road, and I said, whoa, I must have invited you along for this trip. Look at how fast I'm going. And immediately I slowed down. I said, see, I don't want to kill God. Just think, if I did, you'd all be without him. So, you know, that's scary. So I slowed down. I drove the speed limit, and God laughed, and I laughed. And I really believe that today, that God laughs with me, and God cries with me, and God loves me, because I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he also loved me as that drunk lying in the street. He loved me with his whole being when I was that drunk. The difference is, I love me, and I love God. That's the difference. God hasn't changed, but through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you people and him, I have changed. And I know that the joy is in the journey, and the best is yet to come. Isn't that wonderful? The best is yet to come. That's awesome. If it's this good, what's it going to be like? Why would I ever want to leave and miss a moment like this? This is the best moment of my life because it's the only one I have. I don't know what's going to happen 5 minutes from now, so I better enjoy this one. It may be my last. And that's not a negative thought. That's a real positive thought for me. Enjoy the moment. And I'm going to close with this. I went to the Seattle convention with Eve. I picked her up in Fort Lauderdale. She was just recovering from some major, major cancer surgery. And we convinced each other that we were going to go together. And she was in desperate shape still. And I remember opening the door and saying, well, you ready? And I looked at her and I thought, oh, my God, I'm taking this lady cross-country to die. That's just what I'm doing. She's going to die. But I didn't tell her that. I mean, I just said, come on, you ready? We're ready to go. We have to get in the car. Plane's waiting. Driving down to the airport, I'm looking outside of her. I'm thinking, oh, she's going to die. She's just going to die. Sitting on the plane, I look at her and I said, she's dying. She's going to die. Right here in the air, she's going to die. Got to Seattle. We got in the room. I looked at her and I said, oh, never going to make it. Sunday morning, she wakes up and she says, oh, I can't do this. I'm just too weak. I may even die. I said, you cannot. You can die, at least not today. You've got to speak. He said, I don't think I can. I'm so weak. And there was another lady there with us, Mary. And Mary and I helped to get dressed. And Mary and I kept saying to her, you can do it, Eve. You can do it. And we got in this beautiful limo. And she's saying, I can't. I'm just so weak. I don't think I can do it. I'm shaking. I just can't do it. Yes, you can, Eve. You're not going to die because too many people are praying for you. You can do it. We got to the stadium, Kingdome, and all in the back waiting for her to get on the stage, and she said, I just don't know. I just don't know. Yes, you can, Eve. You can do it. You can do it. And I'm looking at Mary and saying, she's going to die. We put her on the stage, and Mary and I went down to sit and watch what was going on, and I watched the miracle happen. And I have never had a more spiritual moment in my life than to watch what happened at that moment in that kingdom as Eve got up to speak. Here was a woman who couldn't even walk beyond the wheelchair, and she stood up and just strutted. I mean, she strutted across that, stood at that podium with hand on hip and says, hi, I'm Eve and I'm an alcoholic. Whoa! Mary and I grabbed hold of each other and cried. Just sobbed. Not with pain, just with joy. Just with joy. And she spoke, and I looked over, and there's this guy with the motorcycle boots and the jacket and the chains and the fifth chapter, and tears are running down his face. And here's this motorcycle guy identifying with, at that time, a 70-something-year-old woman. And I started to cry, not with sadness, but with joy. And after Eve sat down, the applause started, and it just started. And all of a sudden, it was so loud, it felt like the kingdom was rocking. It felt like the whole building was rocking with the sound of it. And I cried, not from sadness, but from joy. And then at the very end, the man spoke, and then they brought this little girl out to the microphone, this little tiny little thing, 8 months sober. No music. And she sang Amazing Grace. And I'll tell you, when it started, everybody was sitting down, and she sang about two or three lines of it, and nobody said, stand up. But it was as if somebody shouted, stand up, because everybody stood up. And we all took hands. And you know when you're holding somebody else's hands, you can't wipe away the tears? Even when you want to? You know how we get this? Well, we couldn't do it. And I just started to cry, not from sadness, but from joy. That was one of the most wonderful moments of my life. And the only thing I had to do was to show up. I had nothing to do with it. I just had to be there. So if you have the opportunity to be there, any place, go there. You may miss the most important moment of your life. I will never forget that. And I'm truly grateful to this program, God as I understand it, for who I am today and what I hope to be. I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous for God. Thanks for being here.